Welcome to the London Walks podcast.
This episode, Shakespeare and London, Part 2. Written and presented by Andy Hallett.
So I'm standing here at the site of the Church of St. Mary Aldermanbury, and there's a wonderful monument, a bust of William Shakespeare, and a dedication to the first folio, Mr. William Shakespeare's Comedies, Histories and Tragedies, published according to the true original copies, London 1623. So they were presenting the first folio, 36 plays, cured and perfect of their limbs, so they said. And on the other side of the monument, we can learn a little bit more about John Hemmings. He lived in this parish upwards of 42 years, in which he was married. He had 14 children. He was buried here at this site October the 12th, 1630. Some people say he may have been the first Falstaff. Henry Condell lived in this parish upwards of 30 years. He had 9 children, so that's 23 children between the two of them, buried here December the 29th, 1627. Now, we think there were something like 750 first folios made, 230 of which still survive today. Now, 80 or so of those are at the Folger Museum in Washington, D.C. The British Museum, I think, has 4, the V&A 3, Durham University has one as well. I don't need to go to America, I don't need to go to Oxford or Durham. I can walk across the road to the Guildhall Library. I'm very lucky, I'm going to get to see this fantastic edition of the first folio. Okay, I'm with Peter Ross, who's the senior librarian, and he's showing me Shakespeare's first folio. We've got a few of them here, actually. We've got the first folio, and
We've got the third folio and the fourth folio.
Okay, brilliant. So this is 391 years old,
yes.
If my mathematics is correct.
I believe you, yes. So 1623. Yes.
What's the difference between a folio and a quarto?
Okay, a folio is named after its size. So a folio piece of paper, basically, is one piece of printer's paper folded in half to create 4 pages. A quarto means you fold it in half again,
right,
which you get 8 pages.
Okay.
So it's just a size designation.
And how much would that cost in 1623?
We believe it cost about £1 if you bought
right.
it bound, or 15 shillings, 75p, if you bought
okay.
it unbound.
Wow, okay. So what's the equivalent of that today? Is what about
£100? It's expensive. Yes,
right.
expensive.
Okay.
It's something that only fairly wealthy people could have afforded at the
right.
time.
Right.
So it's a status item. That's why it's put into a folio. One, because it has a status. And two, if you've got to fit in 36 plays, then you need to have a large volume to put.
So the amazing thing about this is 18 of these plays have never been published before.
That's right. So 18 have been published in quarto or gathered together in the late teens of that century. Yeah, 18 had not been published, so we'd have lost 18 plays.
Which is incredible, isn't it? Including Macbeth.
Yes, Julius Caesar, I think.
Twelfth Night.
Yep.
All's Well That Ends
All's Well.
Coriolanus, Tempest.
Yep.
All
exactly.
have disappeared.
Yes.
So it's a beautiful piece of work. Now, that's also, I'm looking at the famous, it's a copper engraving, isn't it? I
think, it is a copper engraving, yes, portrait of Shakespeare.
So one of the only, well, perhaps 3 likenesses of Shakespeare we have, I suppose.
Yes, I mean, the Chandos portrait is probably the most likely good portrait of him.
Right.
I must say that I've always regarded the copper plate image that we have here as rather poor. But what's significant is that his friends had commissioned this. So they knew what he looked like. So they must have been fairly happy with what this...
And in fact, Ben Jonson kind of endorses it a little bit,
he does.
Is he being sarcastic?
I think he might be sarcastic about it, yeah.
What I think is amazing about it is the mistakes as well, is the wonderful mistakes. It's kind of a window
yes.
into that world, isn't
yes.
it? What were the mistakes? There were page numbers missing? Or?
The problem with producing a book of that scale, I think it's got something about 800 pages, can't quite remember, is that no printer had enough type to set the entire thing up. So he would set up as much as he could, which is probably quite a small amount of the book, probably a couple of gatherings, you know, say 16 pages, possibly not even that. And then he would print those pages,
yeah.
and then he'd move on to the next one. So, and also when you're calculating for fitting in your type, you have to calculate from the outside of the gathering to the inside. You sometimes have too much space, or you run out of space, so therefore you have to adjust things.
Right.
And also if you spot errors, if you've dismantled your type and
yeah.
want to go back, you can't, and
right.
without resetting the whole of that
okay.
gathering.
Okay.
So errors were often corrected in pen, actually in the printers. Right. If they had noticed it, they might go and reset it just that bit. But on the whole, because they're not printing the book all at once, you start to get errors and start to get squashing up and expanding of text just to make sure it all fits in.
So all folios are unique, are they? Are they all slightly different, or are they...?
Well, there are types for the first folio. So you can group various first folios into types, and if you're a real expert, which I'm not, you can work out when a particular volume was produced, or part of that volume was produced throughout the year of 1622, 1623, by how the type and the corrections work. So there are certain types. Some of them might be unique. There are some that, right from the early printing, it took a long time to print it, and they used to abandon the printing and print something else and come back to it. So some of the very early ones, there may be one or two that are actually unique edition. I believe ours is quite late in the printing run, so it has everything it should have in it, and it's a perfect copy.
So this would have been bound. Would this one been bound or not bound?
Lots of people at the time would have bought it unbound, and then would have taken to their binders and have it bound in their standard binding that fitted with their other books. So this is actually the one that we've got here was bound in the 20th century to look like a 17th century binding.
Troilus and Cressida, for example, was a kind of a later edition almost, wasn't it? Because I don't know if there was a problem with copyright, there was some kind of dithering around it.
They believe they didn't have the right to publish Troilus and Cressida. That's as far as we understand it. And certainly when they began the book, they didn't have the right to it because the catalogue, what's called the catalogue, which is the list of plays, doesn't include Troilus and Cressida. But Troilus and Cressida is included in, I think that's included in every single copy of the first folio. It squashed in a bit, and it meant that other pages had to be moved to accommodate it. I think I'm right in thinking they discovered they did have the right to it in the end, and it just came at the last minute.
So they put it, squeezed in after, after Henry VIII, and they put it at the beginning of the...
I honestly can't remember where it is, but yes.
Coriolanus,
You can certainly...
Without the numbers.
Yes, What's interesting about the first folio is that we sometimes regard it as being a status item in this size, but in fact it's also, because you need that size to squash all the plays in, and they're saving paper all the time because they don't always start a new play on the right-hand side. We would imagine that you start each chapter of a book on the right-hand side. Here, they start left or right, depending on whether they've got spare paper.
Okay.
So the whole thing is really to save paper, because the paper's really expensive. It's imported French paper, I believe. So what you're doing all the time is saving paper. So squashing Troilus and Cressida, they didn't mind squashing up things as long as they didn't waste any paper on it.
And also, I suppose you're doing everything in advance. You're thinking in advance all the time.
That's the great skill of somebody, of a printer at the period.
So they stuck in Timon of Athens, which was maybe maybe written partly by Shakespeare, perhaps it was unfinished.
But they didn't include Pericles. We think, of course, they didn't have the rights to it, because Pericles does appear in the second folio. But then the third and fourth folios have plays that are clearly not by Shakespeare, like the Yorkshire Tragedy.
There was in the 1960s, there was a guy called Charles Hinman who did a kind of proofreading of the first folio, and he thought there were perhaps nine hands involved in putting it together.
Yes.
Some were very, very good, and some were not so good.
Yes.
There was a guy, they've labelled as number E, I think he is, who was probably an apprentice, and his name was John Leeson or something.
Right, yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
And you can recognise them by their spellings. Sometimes spell do with an E on them, for instance, way, the style they use for setting up the type. But mostly from their spellings, you can tell which compositor it is.
So this compared with Ben Jonson's works, for example, which came out in 1616, so it's not as good quality of that, because that
was... It's probably not as good quality as that, but it is the first time that a volume has been devoted just to plays.
Right.
Ben Jonson's also got his poetry in it.
We actually
have on display here, we have a Ben Jonson second volume of the film.
So how much would you pay for a quarto, for example, of a play?
Quarto was, I think, about sixpence.
Okay.
So in fact, if you add it up, it's no more expensive to buy... The first thing it wants to buy all the quartos, but you couldn't have bought all the quartos because they weren't all the plays were published.
Yeah. And there's big differences, huge differences, isn't there? For something like Othello, for example, is very, very different in the quarto to the folio.
Yes, there's much debate about why that is. It used to be thought that it's because the texts were stolen from memory, written down from memory.
So stolen, surreptitious copies.
But now there's people are moving towards the belief that they are genuine reworkings by the company, or possibly by Shakespeare. But you can, it's like it's like anything, it's like the Kennedy assassination. You take your view on what happened.
I mean, the Hamlet quarter, the first Hamlet quarter is much shorter, for example, isn't
yes.
it? An idea is that's perhaps a touring piece.
Because
I think they went to Oxford and they changed the names of it. There's no Polonius or Ronaldo. I think it's Montano. They changed the names because of scholars in Oxford who they're performing in front of. That was one of the kind of ideas.
I didn't know that.
But it's a beautiful piece of work, isn't it? It's an amazing thing.
This is a very fine copy. One of the experts in the world, Dr. Emma Smith, of Oxford University, has inspected our copy. She regards it as one of the 5 best copies in the world.
Wow.
And she did actually say to me that she thought it was the best copy she'd seen. Because it's complete, its condition is fantastic. If you see some other copies, for instance, the one at the Bodleian, the one they reacquired, is in a terrible condition.
Right.
And if you see other ones in America at the Folger, some of them are just in appalling condition.
Right. They've been kind of cannibalised from various things.
So some of them have facsimile. It's the thing that usually goes is the portrait. People collected the image, so that's what's usually missing. But yes, they make it up from different copies or add bits in facsimile.
And more than appropriate here, because around the corner Hemmings and Condo lived, so kind
they
of
did
right
indeed.
Bang next door.
Yes, so I think they live in Coleman Street, which is a few streets along, and there's just outside the window is the monument. Yeah, and Shakespeare lived just at Silver Street, just north of here.
Yes, of course, in the corner, Muggle Street, I read, a bit of Harry Potter.
Yeah, exactly.
So Hemmings and Condé, Hemmings was they were actors and they were friends as well.
Yes.
We know that from the will.
Yeah, there are only 3 people mentioned in the will, I think that's right. 3 other than this family, so Hemmings and Condé and Burbage. And Burbage had died before this was produced. So it's my opinion that those 3 were tasked with doing the first failure, that Burbage had died. The other 2, that's only a theory. There's no proof.
So he died in 1616. It came out eventually in 1623. So do you think they started work on it pretty soon after his death, or a number of years after? We just don't know.
We don't know. It took them. It certainly was in the printers for a long time. It started the year before. It took them a long time to gather together.
And printed by Isaac Jaggard and Edward Blount. So Isaac Jaggard's father was William Jaggard.
That's right.
He printed the Passionate Pilgrim.
That's right. And he died by this point. I believe that's right. And then Isaac took over.
I mean, in a way, that's quite unusual, isn't it? Because a part of the Passionate Pilgrim was some of Shakespeare's sonnets and some pieces taken out of Love, Labour's Lost. And we don't think he gave permission for that. So they've used them the same printers again.
Yeah. I've no idea why they did that, but they did. I've no idea. Okay. I'll comment on that one.
And it's wonderful, isn't it? Because it's the way it's done. It's almost in that kind of ramshackle way a little bit. They put some of it is beautifully edited, and some of it is kind of all over the place. It gives it a certain charm, doesn't it?
Yes.
I think.
We even have, in some cases, the actor's name written rather than the character name. So, for example, in Much Ado About Nothing, we have Dogberry, and then Kemp, Will.
That's right.
So it's brilliant. So presumably that's Will Kemp. And we can see Shakespeare actually writing specifically for particular actors for that and their talents.
Yes, and also that by this date, quite a lot of the plays weren't being performed anymore. So they might not necessarily be in people's memories. If they couldn't get hold of a printed text, they'll be using a manuscript text. They're possibly using people's memories of, is this how you played it? So it may be that they didn't have time to do the full editing, on the text.
So it's taken from what, the foul papers, the rough copies, the prompt copies, the manuscripts, none of which we have survived,
today. No.
So it's these kind of literary heroes, these guys.
They
really
are indeed, yes. I mean, hence, it's right, there should be a monument just outside our window.
Okay, thank you very much, Peter. That's wonderful, and what a pleasure to see it.
Okay.
I've never seen it before, so I'm really, really excited about seeing it.
Good.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Shakespeare and London, Part 2, was written and presented by Andy Hallett.
For details of the full programme of London Walks, London's best guided walking tours, go to www.walks.com. The London Walks podcast was an APB production.